I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sports ad free. That's amazon.com/sports ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It is Monday, which means it's time for the new and improved Front 3 podcast. Me, Adam Boltwood, the one and only Nico Morales.
How you doing, Adam?
And of course, Chris Hennage.
Lovely to be here.
On today's podcast, we're going to be reviewing and previewing the Champions League semi-finals, talking the relegation battle, who's going down in the Premier League, and of course, Barcelona's La Liga win, their 7th title in 10 years. But before all that, though, if you don't follow us on Twitter, you may have missed some news this afternoon about the future of the Front 3. That's okay, I'll fill you in now. As you may have noticed, it's been a busy few months for the Front 3, I think it's fair to say. Life changes for all 5 of us meant the podcast hasn't been as good or as consistent as it should be, and for that we apologise. You know, the future of the Front 3 podcast is something we've been discussing in recent weeks and recent months because we truly appreciate you guys taking the time to listen to us. So many of you have been on this journey with us since the beginning, and together we feel like we've all built a community around this podcast, and for that we couldn't be more grateful. So as I said, we've been working hard to figure out how to move forward with the Front 3, how to make it the best it can be, juggling our work commitments, our life commitments. And that's why we've decided this week that we're coming back bigger and better than ever. That's right, starting today, you'll be getting more TF3 than ever before. Not only the regular weekend review and Q&A podcasts, but also post-match analysis, exclusive interviews, and much, much more. But in order to create this content and continue creating it over the World Cup and into next season, we need your support. At the end of the season, we'll be asking you to back us on Patreon. In exchange, you'll officially become a member of The Hole, and you'll continue to receive all our exciting new content, as well as bonus Patreon exclusives. For those of you who can't support us on Patreon, don't worry, we'll still love you. And you'll still be guaranteed your weekly dose of The Front 3 on Mondays, completely free, as always. But in order to take The Front 3 to the next level, we firmly believe this is the way to give you the best possible podcast. We're truly excited about the future of the Front 3, and we hope that you'll continue on this journey with us. There's lots to come. Stay tuned. It's exciting times, Nico.
100%. And like Adam said, the majority of the podcast, or at least one big file of the podcast, will still be available to you for free forever. We don't want you guys to think we're completely alienating you if you don't have the ability, or if you, you know, don't want, given our consistency, to support us right away. But I am really excited by the amount of people that have come out and said that they would instantly support us. I mean, that's so nice of you guys. We really appreciate that, and we thank you for all your support. But there will be, you know, better content. That's kind of the thing about this, is that we, you know, in order to make this podcast very good, we need to, you know, we have to put more time into it, and that's what we've been trying to do lately. That's what we'll be doing going forward, and you guys backing us on Patreon really helps us do that. So if you do become an official member of The Hole, then you will be getting all of the Front 3 that's possible: exclusive interviews, Q&A podcasts, all that stuff. So it'll be great fun. It'll be better than ever before, like Adam is saying, and I think it's going to be a really good time.
What this gives us the opportunity to do is not only, I think, refocus after a sort of period of haze as we tried to work out the best way to move forward, but also I think it kind of lets us reconnect with the people who listen in a much more direct and expressive ways, as weird as that might sound, because I think what you'll see with this new content that we're going to do is a lot more of how we work and how we operate come out, because I think we can sit and spout opinions to you all day long and that's great, but I think if you do choose to go for the Patreon option, I think you'll almost see a little bit more of our personality come out in the type of work and the type of stuff that we want to do. But I think ultimately, no matter what, whether you choose Patreon or not, I think for me the most important thing is it's almost just an appreciation of those who stuck around, because there's so much competition out there when it comes to listening to podcasts, especially football ones. And I think if you have stuck by with things the way that they were, I think to me that's almost the greatest sense of commitment that we could have got. So for me personally, I think I appreciate that more than anything right now.
We will be releasing more details about our Patreon, how you can support us, what you'll be receiving in exchange for backing us. All the details will be announced at the end of the season. But for now, if you like, this is going to be a month's taster of all the exciting content that you will be getting in the future on the Front Three. We hope that this shows you why you should support us and why you should join us for the new and improved Front Three. For the meantime, myself, Chris, Nico, we are going to be your core Front Three. Dave and Lawrence are still part of the podcast. Dave is taking somewhat of a back seat. He's incredibly busy right now. He's got so many projects on the go, but he isn't going anywhere. He is still part of this podcast. You will be hearing from him very soon. Lawrence as well, a hugely busy man. So many plates that he's spinning. He is still part of the Front Three. But for now, as I say, myself, Chris, Nico, we are going to be the regular starters. Lawrence and Dave, they're going to be coming off the bench. You need a squad approach in this podcast game. But yeah, for all the details, do go and follow us on Twitter at The Front Three. We'll be releasing all the details in due course and explaining how you can back us on Patreon. But for now, watch this space. Right, with all that exciting stuff out of the way, let's talk football. First up is the Champions League. We do have to review the first legs of those semi-finals and preview the second legs this week. First up, Liverpool going into that second leg against Roma with a 5-2 lead after a stunning first leg. I think it's fair to say, Nico, the way Jurgen Klopp's side put Roma to the sword was sensational, although it did feel like the Giallorossi played in to Liverpool's hands.
To a certain extent, yeah. And with, I recently wrote something sort of tactical talking about the different approaches and stuff like that. And I think maybe the thing that I want to highlight the most is that just because, like, for example, Roma had the result against Liverpool doesn't necessarily mean the approach in theory was incorrect. But yeah, they definitely exposed Roma. You could say they played into their hands. Like I said, I think in the preview podcast, would have liked to have seen them be a little bit more defensive, given how teams like Burnley and others that I mentioned have fared against Liverpool, and they've kind of thwarted their attacking efforts because Liverpool like to create space. And Roma, you know, they tried to compact the pitch. They tried to get them to play out of the pressure that they're not very good at doing because they don't have that many players that are that great at doing that. But the problem was is that Liverpool kind of did the same thing that they did to Manchester City. They used the long ball to stretch the pitch. They completely exposed the three at the back through the pace of their front three. Great podcast and really a great attacking trio. And, you know, it just really wasn't good because when you isolate defenders like Juan Jesus and Fazio with Mohamed Salah and Sadio Mane, I mean, it turns out the way it did. So, yeah, I would say it's kind of difficult, but I can see the reason why you say or the coach went with that approach.
It is a very difficult situation Roma find themselves going into the second leg, Chris. They need 3 goals. I mean, we've seen them do that before, but attacking is going to leave space for the one and only Mohamed Salah to exploit, surely.
Yeah, I think for me that was kind of the thing that was most intriguing, because obviously for the Barcelona tie, Di Francesco ripped up his playbook and redesigned the team. And so there's part of me thinking, well, is he going to do that again? Is that possible? Probably not. So does he just go back to a 4-3-3 and put Nainggolan in there and try and give the midfield, the central midfield, more energy, more mobility, and then also stop the back four in this case, if it's a 3-4-3-3, being isolated? I don't think they'll be cavalier, personally. I think they'll try for an early goal. In fact, I was looking at some of the numbers just the other day. And for both of these teams, especially last time out, you had Liverpool concede early at City, you had Roma score early against Barcelona. And between the two of them, they've scored a good amount of early first half goals. So I think Liverpool, possibly rightly so, will sit off a bit. But I don't think at the same time that Roma will throw everything at them straight away. I think they'll try and game manage the situation very precisely.
You could almost say that they kind of went backwards in their approach, right? Because, like I was saying, I think a lot of people would have preferred to see them be more defensive in the first leg and kind of see what they get given they were away from home. But now that they, you know, you would imagine in that kind of situation where they don't have to recover a 3-goal deficit, they would be more attacking. They would try to compress Liverpool and put them under pressure and make them, you know, try to expose a game state situation in sort of an aggregate way where they need to come after them and have Liverpool play into their hands and to that extent. But you would say, almost to some respect, that they did that backwards, right? I mean, that's kind of the difficulty in seeing the legitimacy of Di Francesco's approach, is that it was kind of a weird thing to do in the first leg.
Anything for Liverpool to worry about in this second leg, Nico, for you, or is it done and dusted?
I think so. Given this level of competition in the Champions League, I think anything can happen. And given how much Di Francesco changed in the second leg for Barcelona, I mean, he has literally this season overturned the same deficit, right? 3 goals against Barcelona. But at the same time, the game state situation, that's kind of what I was alluding to before, completely favors Liverpool because they can be compact and defensive and force Roma to expose themselves. That's why it was, you know, so weird. You want to try to play for the second leg. You want to set yourself up well so that it kind of comes down to the second leg, and they very much did not do that. The only way that they can kind of go after it or win this game is if Liverpool completely shit the bed, for lack of a better term. So, Exactly. So I mean, if Liverpool messed this up, I mean, they've really messed it up.
Staying on Liverpool for a moment, much has been made of the departure of Zico Buvac today from the club, Klopp's right-hand man of 17 years. He's taken the decision to take some time away from the club for personal reasons. Some reports, though, Chris, claiming there's been some sort of bust-up between the two.
I haven't heard any specific reasons as to why he's leaving. One of the things that stuck out to me recently, though, was just over the weekend where I read that their relationship, it was quite polarizing in its makeup, because the way it was characterized in the piece that I read was that one minute they could be having quite a heated discussion about maybe a tactical idea or whatever, and he would storm out of Klopp's room, and then within 10 minutes they'd be back, the exact phrase that was used, back in each other's arms, kind of laughing and joking again. And I think from my own experiences in life, relationships like that have a sell-by date, and there's a point where the argument maybe oversteps one or the other. But I think at the same time, it's somewhat unfair and disingenuous to speculate when he said had personal reasons, because that could be a very wide scope of possibilities. And so I think it's best to take it on face value and just respect what is there.
Yeah, I think you're right. To take it at face value as it stands now, we'll see how it develops. I'm sure there's more to come from this story. Finally, before we move on Liverpool, Roberto Firmino over the weekend signing a new 5-year deal at the club alongside Salah Nico. He has been one of Liverpool's most important players this season. So great news for Liverpool fans.
100%. Like I've said before on this podcast, I think he's played a major role in the effectiveness of both Mohamed Salah and Sadio Mane. He kind of connects them. A lot of what they do long ball-wise, which is actually really important because, as I've kind of touched on tactically in the last couple matches against both Roma and Liverpool and other teams that try to pressure Liverpool, is that they do have that option. I mean, a lot of times in the tactical community, we kind of, you know, dismiss that approach of playing long ball football, but it is really important when you have a player like Firmino that you can go directly to and win a significant portion of those battles, that you can isolate defenders like Liverpool have. So it's really good to see how far he's come in terms of when he signed for Liverpool, because certainly when he came from Hoffenheim under Brendan Rodgers, I didn't think he was very good, and he's transformed into probably one of the better players in his position at Liverpool under Klopp. So it's good to see.
As for the other semi-final. Bayern Munich are facing Real Madrid at the Santiago Bernabeu, trailing 2-1. Jupp Heynckes calling on his side to be more efficient in this second leg. In the first leg, of course, they had 18 shots, but finished with a sixth successive defeat against Real Madrid. What do you make of this second leg, Chris? Is there a way back for Bayern Munich?
I think for me, if I was a Bayern fan, I'd be really frustrated with that first leg because it was self-immolation. It was a team who, as you say, created a number of very good chances, and really Rafinha's mistake, without wishing to single out the individual, is what facilitates Asensio's goal and really puts them back in the game and pushes them through to a victory, rather. So I think for me, you can't afford to make those kind of mistakes. It's as simple as that. It's there's no other way to characterise it. And I think the second leg is quite hard to predict specifically in terms of goals because, for me, Real Madrid have really danced between two very different standards in this competition. The fact they didn't dominate the group stages, obviously they were beaten away by Tottenham and then drew at home. Even Juventus obviously had the better of them last time out, beating them 3-1. And yet they seem to have this sort of boxers mentality where they ride the ropes for 10, 15 minutes, they come under sustained pressure, and then they just swing with this one punch that catches the opposition out, like they did with Asensio. And next thing you know, you're 2-1 down and potentially going out of the competition. Now, that for me is possibly why they are so good in this competition. And to digress very briefly, I do wonder if this is maybe what we're going to see with Messi and Ronaldo when they do eventually call time on things, is that Messi is the one that won more league titles, so he is defined by the course of a season, being able to produce moments in games and across a season, whereas Ronaldo, the Champions League seems so perfect for him, whether it's 90 minutes, 180, 120, he just seems made for that one occasion, just being able to summon up the strength to go once more, to go again and do it when he's needed across those two kind of periods that we have with these ties. So it's yeah, to me at least, I think Real Madrid go through. Personally, that's my opinion. But yeah, the score I think could really be picked out of a hat and not questioned.
They are without Isco and Danny Carvajal, Real Madrid, Nico. Zinedine Zidane suggesting earlier this week, perhaps Cristiano Ronaldo could play at right back in this game. Is that how Bayern could exploit this Madrid side?
Possibly. I mean, I think they really did enough to exploit them in the first game. I think Jupp Heynckes' tactical approach was really, really good in the sense that what they did a lot of the time and what any team really wants to avoid is ball progression through the middle of the field, and that's exactly what they did. They didn't want to compete with Real Madrid down the wings because essentially no one can, given Marcelo and Carvajal and all the other players that they have in those positions. And so they provoked Real Madrid's pressing players, Lucas Vazquez, whoever else, through the middle, and then got Mats Hummels to, as he always does and as he always has throughout his career, progress the ball really well through the middle. Varane and Ramos, if I'm correct in saying that, he was playing that game, dealt with Robert Lewandowski exceptionally well, and I think they were unlucky to enjoy the result that they did, and Real Madrid have set it up well for themselves in the second game. But I think the result there was more down to luck than anything else, and really a Rafinha mistake that, you know, is uncharacteristic of the player and just it's kind of a hazard of the job. But in terms of the second leg, as to how they go exposing Real Madrid, I think if they do the same thing in the second leg, then they come out victorious. Then there's not too much that they need to change in their approach because they did really well, and not that many teams have been able to exploit Real Madrid in that way. And I think it was a really intelligent way to do it.
You say lucky. The stats would back that up. The expected goals was 1.1 for Bayern, 0.3 for Real Madrid. Is that right?
Yes, it was, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that says it all. It'd be interesting to see how the second leg goes then. But yeah, it looks like we could be having a Liverpool-Real Madrid sort of nostalgic throwback final as it stands.
It was interesting as well to kind of talk about Bayern's performance in a different light. Their game, they essentially had to change their game plan, what, maybe 8 or 9 minutes in after Arjen Robben went out with an injury, and they don't have Kingsley Coman, who's probably preferred to Frank Ribery, given how old he is and how many minutes he's played. And then Thiago, surprisingly, was not, you know, part of the starting 11. But, you know, I think you know, like I said before, I think they did really well in the first leg to expose that, and I think it just requires a repeat. The difficulty is that it's Real Madrid, it's at home, it's the semifinals of the Champions League. I mean, there is no bigger occasion for which that club can shine.
As for the Europa League, Marseille, 2-0 up in the first leg against Salzburg, looking like they're cruising through to the final. Arsenal, though, had a very disappointing first leg against Atletico Madrid. It all started so well. The goal for Arsenal, the chances created. But in the end, as Arsene Wenger said, Chris, the worst possible result for Arsenal, that away goal leaving them a mountain to climb.
Yeah, I thought it was a hugely frustrating game from an Arsenal perspective. I thought, yes, they did create a huge number of chances and they deserve credit for that. I did also come away thinking that really it was a bit of a sort of stereotypical performance from Simeone and his team. It was what I kind of expected, almost, I'm loath to say masterclass because they conceded a lot of chances, but you get the point I'm trying to make. And I think this is the problem, is the second time round, I can't imagine that Atletico will be that naive as to pick up two yellow cards so quickly. And to be fair, Atletico could, if they really wanted to, I was going to use a swear word there, but say in the ultimate bout of S-housery, trot out and try and get a 0-0 or even a 1-0, because it's a result that I think they've become very adept at producing. So this is a really difficult one for Arsene Wenger and Arsenal, which is all compounded by the awful, awful away form that they've had in 2018. Even in Moscow, they weren't very convincing there, I thought personally. They conceded a lot of chances to a CSKA side that are very much put together on a shoestring. So I guess if there was a time for Arsenal's player to sort of stir themselves from the canvas, to use another boxing analogy, this is it. This is sort of the last chance to learn, I think.
I think I'm right in saying they're the only team in England's top four divisions to not have a single away win, might even be a single point away from home in 2018. Of course, another defeat to Manchester United at the weekend. Is there any way back for Arsenal, Nico? I mentioned that away goal. There's injury concerns for Alex Iwobi, Henrik Mkhitaryan as well.
Yeah, and as someone that hasn't kept up with the Europa League as much as I've kept up with the Champions League, I almost thought it was the second leg after hearing all of the reports from this match, given that Arsenal really only conceded once and Atletico Madrid had the away goal. But that's the difficulty, is that they didn't capitalize upon a situation which I think most people imagine they would or should, and it's Diego Simeone's Atletico Madrid. There is no other team. They're the quintessential defensive team in Europe, and they have been for a number of years now. So as much as someone could probably imagine Arsenal scoring more than one goal, it's really difficult to imagine that at the Jose Calderon against Diego Simeone's really, really, really competent defensive side. So, yeah, I think it was probably the worst possible result and probably a bad send-off for Wenger in Europe, because I think many Arsenal fans, given the almost reimagining of what they define as success, they would have liked to see, you know, a Europa League victory or at least a Europa League final, and they might not even get that this season, so...
My fingers are crossed. I'm not sure I could handle Arsenal winning the Europa League in their worst ever season while Spurs remain empty-handed. That would be tough to take. Right, let's talk about the relegation battle. It's hotting up in the Premier League. The title's done and dusted. Spurs are now 5 points ahead of Chelsea with 3 games to go after winning against Watford tonight, meaning the relegation battle is where it's at. As the season comes to a close, there's just 3 points separating Southampton in 18th on 32 points and West Ham in 15th on 35 points. You've also got Huddersfield in 16th place and Swansea in 17th place in the mix. Who do we think is going down here? Let's talk through some of the teams, some of the potential candidates for the drop. First up, Stoke, Chris. They're 19th at the moment with 30 points. They're 3 points from safety with 2 games to play. Despite that, very impressive, I think, point against Liverpool, although they're playing a weakened team at Anfield this weekend. Southampton and Swansea have got a game in hand on Stoke, but they do face Palace and Swansea in their final 2 games. They're not quite dead and buried yet, Chris?
Yeah, I think
It's such a difficult one, because I was thinking about this today. If I was in their position, would I want to play teams around me, or would I want teams in that bracket from, say, 8th to 10th, who really have got nothing to...
Yeah, someone like Leicester,
yeah,
maybe.
You look at Leicester. I mean, granted, Everton put out a fantastic performance against Huddersfield at the weekend, but I think Huddersfield are in a tailspin. So there's certainly, I think, a lot of deconstruction that goes into this when you're a fan near the bottom of the table, because you almost try to give yourself, I think, some self-confidence and some reassurance that, oh yeah, we can win this because, as you say, Leicester have got nothing to play for, or Bournemouth have got nothing to play for, when the teams around you, you would imagine they'd be up for it, and yet at the same time, they're in the same boat as you for a reason. It's not necessarily a case of a lack of effort, it's a lack of quality that defines them. The thing with Stoke is they've got Palace at home. I think Palace, for me personally, when I've seen them away from home and the makeup of their squad, they seem quite a difficult away team to play against, because they're very quick. They've got a lot of good runners. Loftus-Cheek, Zaha, Townsend in there as well, who I think would make me almost wary of being too aggressive in attacking, because that would put you rife for a counter-attack going the other way. Swansea City on the last day away from home. Personally, I've not been that impressed with Swansea of late. I know that Carlos Carvajal is fantastic for a quote and a good line and a funny metaphor, which I can appreciate as someone who's really stretched them on here at times. But a lot of their play seems almost like it was when I saw Sheffield Wednesday under him, which was a little laborious, not the most inventive, not the most creative, often away from home, trying to get a 1-0 if possible, happy with a 0-0 though if it comes that way. So I think the fact that they haven't scored a huge number of goals is not a terrible surprise to me. But I think Stoke are going to need... I think if I'm Stoke right now, personally, I'm looking at Huddersfield thinking they may not pick up any points. So if we can get those two wins and just leapfrog them with that one extra point, then everything's coming up Millhouse.
In many ways, it does feel like Huddersfield are in trouble. City, Chelsea and Arsenal are their final three fixtures, so it's very difficult to see them getting any more points, and they are just 3 points clear of Southampton 18th.
I must also say, as a friend mm-hmm. kind of pointed out to me today, for some reason we were talking about Leicester's title winning season. They won the title with 81 points, and that was 10 points clear of Arsenal. Manchester City with 3 games left to spare have 93 points and are likely to break 100. I mean, we talk about, and kind of the reason I bring that up is because kind of looking at the we're talking about the relegation battle, obviously, and we're kind of looking at the very light difference in points between really the ones that are really in trouble for relegation and even those in 11th or 12th or 13th or whatever it may be. And I think it a lot of people are kind of talking about this separation between the top and the bottom. And basically from Arsenal on up, it's kind of difficult to see those games where any of the bottom sides or anyone really past 12th was able to compete with those at the top. And it's just, for me, it was really interesting to see that Leicester City actually won the title. And matter of fact, someone came second with 71 points that season, and our Premier League champions this season could break 100 points. I mean, there's obviously a massive difference in kind of season to season in competition. But I mean, for any team to really win that many times in one season is pretty incredible, in my opinion, at least.
It's a huge gulf. It is interesting as well, of course, Palace beating Leicester 5-0 at the weekend, well and truly on the beach as well. So West Ham, who've got Leicester up next, will probably be looking at that game as the one to potentially get them the 3 points that would almost guarantee safety. Who do you think is going to go down here, Chris? Because, I mean, West Brom, they've turned around their form recently. There's 2 wins and 2 draws in the last 4 games. It's too little too late, I think it's safe to say, even though they're not mathematically down yet. You've got Stoke then on 30 points and then Southampton on 32. I mean, would you be sad to see Southampton go, given the struggles they've had this season? Would you rather see someone like Swansea maybe go down? I mean, I'd rather see West Ham myself. But who do you think's going down, Chris, from these sort of potential 5 or 6 candidates?
I mean, look, West Ham haven't got a great run in either, to be fair. They've got Man United and Everton at home. Yes. Everton seem a bit Jekyll and Hyde all of a sudden away from home. And then Leicester away, which again is not a great set of results. I have a sneaking suspicion West Ham will be okay for some reason. I don't know what that is. Maybe just situation. For me, the interesting one in this is what you touched on there, Swansea, because they play not only Stoke, but also Southampton, who, I mean, to be fair, Southampton looked dead and buried until this weekend against Bournemouth. Mm. And they seem to have just sort of, I don't know what it is with Southampton, they almost just seem to care again, which sounds a very bizarre thing to say. I read a piece recently that said there was a lot of division in the ranks there between some of the English players and the foreign players, and there wasn't a huge amount of confidence in Wesley Hoed, the Dutch centre-back who came in and was perhaps seen as a replacement for Virgil van Dijk, who I think we're now starting to see the influence he had on that team. Not necessarily as a footballer, but as a leader and someone who held the group together. Because you look at players like Mario Lemina, who in the first half of the season were fantastic. I'd have swapped anything for Mario Lemina. Whereas during that second half of the season, he's just looked a bit indifferent and a bit apathetic sometimes. And it's those intangibles that I appreciate we can't always quantify on the podcast, but those are the things that concern you because they're expected. And I think that's the thing with Swansea, is that because they have both Southampton and Stoke, they're going to have two really big crunch matches in theory. So they're going to have to try and ride out with that and try and get some points, because they are only on 33. So a win for Stoke, a win for Southampton, or actually probably going to need to be maybe 4 points for Stoke, given the goal difference they're on. But 4 points for Stoke, a win for Southampton. Next thing you know, it's Swansea and Huddersfield planning for a 46-game season.
I think Huddersfield could really get sucked into it. Swansea, as you mentioned, playing Southampton and Stoke in their final two games, both at Swansea, both at home. So that could be crucial. Have you got any shouts who's going down, Nico? A bold prediction of Huddersfield going to suddenly drop into the bottom three?
I imagine... I want to say Swansea, because as much love as I have for Bobby Gardner, you know, their manager doesn't, he said something egregious about statistics one time, and Southampton will probably be the most talented side to ever go down, given how much talent they have on that team. So I'd like to see Swansea go down. I really don't want to see Southampton face relegation, but yeah.
Would you not like to see Mark Hughes relegate two teams in
one
season?
Like, you know, that's the terrible choice that you're giving me there. You say, yeah, I want to see Mark Hughes out of the game. The one time I interviewed him, he was a dick to me. He's also, you know, Mark Hughes.
Oh, you've got a personal vendetta against Mark
Hughes. I have
Mark
a personal Hughes, vendetta. This podcast has a personal vendetta towards Mark Hughes, so it's par for the course. But, I mean, it is Southampton. They still are a great club. I don't know what they were doing hiring Mark Hughes. They have Dusan Tadic, who's, you know, one of my favorites, Mario Lemina, who is the next Moussa Dembele. So they have all these great players. They should not go down. And I mean, none of those players are going to stay if they do. So, but yeah, I'd like to see Swansea go down.
Maybe Southampton, so Spurs can get Lemina and replace Dembele on the cheap.
Can I also bring my receipt to the table and say, I did say West Ham were going to be in trouble at the beginning of the season. I also said Stoke were going to be in trouble at the beginning of the season. And Stephen Housen said West Brom could take Arsenal's place, I think, in the top six or something like that, and they're finishing dead last.
Did he say that? So, did Stephen say that? Because it felt like...
He said something along those lines. He said they could.
Yeah, I think I jokingly suggested that West Brom could leapfrog Arsenal, and Stephen Housen sort of non-committally said, yeah, maybe they could. And now it's been taken as, Housen said West Brom are going to finish in the top six or something.
That's a ridiculous thing to say, though.
The one thing I'd say about Huddersfield, just quickly, is that they finished last season awfully on negative goal difference. Granted, I think they put their eyes firmly on the playoff race, knowing they would qualify. But my goodness, they just ran out of steam completely, possibly because of the way they play. And I've got a sneaking suspicion that's about to happen again.
Yeah, that final game at Arsenal feels like that could
that's
be
their
there.
Do or die.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I think no points there and they're going down, I think.
Finally, this week, we have to talk Barcelona. Barcelona confirming their La Liga title victory this weekend with a 4-2 victory over Deportivo La Coruña, Nico. Clarence Seedorf's Deportivo La Coruña.
Yeah, a very good Deportivo La Coruña side, but still won this season. I mean, Barcelona did secure their relegation with, I think, 2 or 3 games to go after winning this one. But it's been interesting, kind of. I think we were going to kind of talk about how some people felt that it's the same kind of thing with Manchester City. Their season is ultimately defined by their performance in the Champions League, and even though they are on the cusp, or actually I guess already achieved it in some sense, even though they still have league games to play that could mar that record, they will achieve or hope to achieve a La Liga season unbeaten. I mean, that's incredible. And given how they've played, given everything that happened before the season, they lost Neymar, obviously. They did buy Philippe Coutinho, probably one of the better players in the world, in their January transfer window. Not a situation many clubs are in the fortunate position of being in. But at the same time, I think they've done well to kind of write the narrative that was written about them before the season even began.
It does feel like this league win is somewhat undervalued, perhaps due to the lack of serious competition for the title. It is the earliest a Spanish league title has been won in 20 years. As you say, Nico, perhaps it will be valued more if Barcelona do remain unbeaten, the first team to do so since 1932.
But yeah, it's interesting that you say that, and I don't mean to violently disagree with you in any fashion, but just look at this Deportivo La Coruña win or loss, for example. Like, that's something that I wrote about earlier this year in terms of, will Manchester City face difficulty in the Champions League because of a lack of approach in terms of English teams? And I think the opposite is true of Barcelona. Deportivo La Coruña won the ball back a number of times by high pressing Barcelona, which is something that you rarely see here in England from English teams and really around Europe. I think their La Liga, even of teams that are secured to be relegated now, they have more in-depth tactical approaches. And although it didn't work out in this specific case, you see teams like Real Betis and other teams that are challenging Barcelona, how they don't necessarily want to be challenged, which I think makes those teams better. Messi, Suarez, Coutinho, all these guys have better experience playing under pressure. And I think they tactically become a more versatile team because I think there is a more dynamic approach to pretty much any team in the Liga. And I was talking to Om Arnvid, who is the managing editor of the SB Nation's Madrid website, which is probably one of the largest congregations of English-speaking Madrid fans, I think, in the world. And he kind of mentioned to me that I mentioned this theory to him a while ago, and he said, yeah, I mean, it checks out. La Liga team's PPDA rating, which just stands for passes per defensive action, their rating was generally higher than most teams in Europe, and it just that metric kind of quantifies a high press. So it's kind of interesting to see that narrative and talking about it and how Barcelona don't really live up to that. They do have a relatively fierce competition in their league.
And of course, this weekend, that competition coming from Real Madrid, who are going to be out to spoil the party, spoil that unbeaten record in El Clasico. Sergio Ramos as well saying Madrid are not going to give their rivals the traditional guard of honour for the champions, which should be interesting. But, I mean, Chris, despite this league win, I think what's interesting is Valverde himself has sort of remarked that defeat to Roma in the Champions League, it has marked their season. Like I say, if they remain unbeaten, it may be valued differently, but right now it's 3 years in a row Barcelona have been knocked out of the quarterfinals of the Champions League. Once again, another disappointing performance this season. How do they reassert themselves as a force in Europe. It feels like, you know, they've dominated the league for the past 10 years, which we'll discuss in a moment. But do they need more quality and depth in their squad? Is it as simple as that? Antoine Griezmann is someone who's long been rumoured to be joining the club this summer.
Yeah, the Ramos thing tickled me as well. I believe there's a chant that Nico will probably know quite well that will clear what Barcelona fans think they should do with the Guard of Honour. I think how they get back to Champions League or European success, that to me is such a difficult question, because really I think the problem is that the way that they've played, and specifically the quality of players, has meant that there's been almost a little bit of a laziness towards reliance on Messi, or at least that's what I took from watching them against Chelsea and Roma, because in both games, certainly in the second leg against Roma, if you shut down the space and make it so he's literally got nowhere to play, there's no one sort of... everyone. Messi is one of those players that when he gets the ball, for some reason, a lot of his teammates tend to go static. And for me, that is, it's a bizarre thing, but it needs to be rectified at the same time. I totally see why you would move him into a central position, because he's such a wonderful footballer. The idea of buying Griezmann, to me, doesn't seem to solve the problem. I don't think adding another attacker in there just fixes things. I think you almost have to open up the machine and tweak the way the ball is moved rather than the players that are moving it. That to me is what springs out. Now, how you fix that, I don't have the answer right now. If Barcelona want to fly me over, I'm happy to spend the weekend trying to come up with something. But I think that's
where... there's an offer there. It's an interesting point Chris raises there, Nico. I mean, Messi, of course, has had another incredible season. I think it's 31 goals in the league, another stunning total. But is there that sense that he's not as effective in Europe as he could be, with the team not set up to help him do that?
I think it's more of maybe a conversation to be had about how much weight we put on, you know, European competition in terms of perception. Like I said before, their season is almost entirely defined about what they do in Europe, you know, regardless of the fact that they may achieve something wonderful domestically. But at the same time, I think, to speak to the points that Chris was talking about in terms of buying Griezmann, who has been a target for them for a while, or a rumored target, it's more about replacing an aging Suarez, who clearly, from a physical aspect, is suffering. Like, he has always been someone that I think is kind of, in some sense, maybe not to an extreme like Higuain is, but to some extent has struggled with keeping maybe a more athletic physique. And is clearly doing so in every match I see him. And not only that, but he is just suffering from the fact that he's getting older. He's not as physical as he used to be. He's not as quick. He's a little bit heftier in his movements. So I think the Griezmann transfer would more address that kind of thing. And I think Griezmann is the type of player, we've seen it with France, we've seen it with Diego Costa, we've seen it with different players at Atletico Madrid. He can sort of play a supplemental role or work well with somebody else. So even if he's not their main target, if they decide to put someone else centrally, a lot of those players are very fluid. Philippe Coutinho wanders around the middle very fluidly. Messi, as Chris kind of alluded to there, goes, even in the game at the weekend against La Coruña, he went from the right wing to central positions, and Ousmane Dembele does similar things, and I think that's what they're looking to make him do. They're trying to make him a more complete player by making him more fluid. So I think Griezmann, with all those players, will kind of help that. What they do need to evaluate also in the summer is the fact that, and I'm sure we'll speak about this in more depth, is that someone like Iniesta is leaving. And I think James York pointed this out in midseason, when kind of the narrative of them not necessarily being in crisis sort of started to dissipate, was that they still are depending on some very old players to do a lot of things for them. Iniesta has played a large role in the last couple of years. I mean, Busquets is so incredibly pivotal to how that team looks to possess the ball and get themselves out of trouble. Like I mentioned before, there are a lot of La Liga teams that look to press them very aggressively and very high up the field, and without Busquets, I don't see them getting out of a lot of the situations. And there's not a Busquets, you know, running around every they're not growing on trees, for lack of a better word. So it can be really difficult to replace that kind of player. And so with that, with these recruitment things, we look at from an analysis perspective. You don't just try to go out and say, okay, let's get a player that's going to perform exactly like Busquets, because the likelihood of finding someone like that, even for Barcelona, even with the buying power that they have, is unlikely. You have to try to maybe, as Chris was talking about there, open up the hood, open up the engine of the car and say, how can we change the play differently so that we aren't facing a significant drop off in performance if we lose this player, if we lose that player? And for Barcelona, there are a lot of positions where they, especially in midfield, where they need to address those problems.
It's they have won the double. I think, you know, we're examining these issues of Barcelona. They have won the double, which is nothing to sniff at. And I mean, you mentioned it there, Nico, especially considering at the start of the season, this was a club on the verge of crisis. Neymar, of course, left PSG. There was that vote of no confidence in the club's president. But how has Ernesto Valverde managed to orchestrate this success from the jaws of failure? What has he done on the pitch that has transformed this side?
Well, he's utilized Messi in a different way. And I think he's also done something similar to that of what the manager before him did, Luis Enrique, is that he's kind of gone away from the stereotypical Barcelona that we know, which is to be this all-dominating possession team. They still use a lot of possession. They still do those things. But they can allow themselves to be defensive. For a large portion of the year, they didn't have Ousmane Dembele. So a lot of the time, they were forced to kind of retract the ball back, play through pressure. And a lot of the time, as I've spoken about, you know, a number of times, both here and in my writing, you can create the, like, we all know when we're watching football that a counter-attacking situation is fantastic for the attacking team, because all of the factors sort of favor the ones who are trying to score a goal, right? So if you can play through pressure, if a team is high-pressing you, if they're holding a high line against you, if you can play through that, then you have essentially created a counter-attacking situation without needing to cede possession. And so much of what Barcelona have done this season, from what I've seen of them, and I've seen quite a few games now, that's what they're doing. They're playing into other teams' hands. They say, okay, we're going to dominate the ball and try to break you down. And if that's not successful, they let teams come onto them. They use the talents, the distribution of Andre Ter Stegen, the ball, you know, ability of someone like Umtiti and Busquets and other guys like that to progress through high pressure. And then they have the open field. And when you have Messi dribbling at a back four, or Coutinho, or any of those extremely talented players, you're going to have success. And to some extent, we can kind of branch into this, the discussion of their performance in Europe. That's a really good league approach, because there are a variety of different opponents that can succumb to those kind of tactics. But when you're facing a team of a greater quality that has the tactical ability to manipulate you, to stretch your formation and do those kind of things, I think that's where you kind of fail. And as we're seeing now, you know, this is, like, I think, the ninth La Liga title that Iniesta and Messi will win together, and obviously the final one for Iniesta. It's maybe a lack of a more, or rather of a less domineering approach that kind of has failed them in Europe to some extent, wouldn't you say?
Well, yeah, it's, I think more broadly speaking, it's nine titles for Iniesta, as you say. It's that domination of the league, which has been so interesting. I like the way that Barcelona's social media team were positioning this one. It's 7 out of the last 10 league titles for Barcelona. They seem to be saying on Twitter earlier, I forget, the being the first team to win back-to-back Champions League, this is the real era defining achievement, Chris. Would you go along with that? 7 of the last 10, it is phenomenal.
Yeah, it's funny. I was watching something with Brian Clough today. It flashed up on my YouTube suggested. And he basically said, you know, I'd trade the League Cup, the FA Cup, the European Cup just to win the league. He said, because from a management perspective, you need a bit of everything to win the league. And I think the same goes with players too. You know, you need consistency at least, especially in performance. And we often talk about the, you know, those difficult midweek away games where sometimes the title is won and lost. And I think for that reason, they deserve tremendous credit, because it's a league title at its core is about consistency. And to win 7 of the last 10, as I believe you said, there was that in itself is, you know, almost consistency squared, you could argue.
Well said.
I think just to kind of branch into that as well, like, You mentioned there Barcelona's social media account talking about, you know, trying to position these things in a way that is favorable for them. So 7 titles in 10 years, 7 La Liga titles. I mean, that's an incredible achievement. We talk about the consistency that Manchester City have had for winning the league in the manner in which they've done this season in the Premier League. But I think for a lot of people out there, and I don't know if this is the case for you too, but we kind of look at Real Madrid's achievements or their possible achievements and say, if they win the Champions League this year, that's 3 Champions Leagues in a row. That's incredible. And I think we would almost say that's more impressive than 7 league titles or however many league titles Iniesta and Messi have won together, right? So from a logistical standpoint, I think the reason that we kind of look at it in that manner is because there are so few teams that win the Champions League. There's so much that kind of goes into the Champions League in terms of, we look at it as Europe's premier competition, which it is. It has the best teams across the continent and stuff like that. But I mean, which should really be viewed as more impressive? The consistency across, you know, what is 7 times 38 quickly is like 266 games versus possibly being lucky for a season or whatever. Like, how should we look at these things? And is that a discussion that I think as football fans we need to have?
I think it is a very interesting discussion. There's something I think about the Champions League, about the prestige of it, of those stunning moments that seem to arise in the competition that means it is valued more highly above a league title. I think, you know, we've spoken about this a couple of times recently, but the fact that, apart from in Serie A, of course, it feels like, you know, the league winners has been obvious. Manchester City, Bayern Munich, Barcelona, they had the titles sewn up in back in December. So therefore, I think those achievements are undervalued somewhat. But I think that's unfair, as you say, the consistency over the season, over that number of games. And for Barcelona, that number of years, to win 7 out of 10 is staggering, I think. Whereas Real Madrid, I think the Champions League is an incredibly impressive achievement. And don't get me wrong, back-to-back Champions League, to be the first team to have done that is phenomenal. But I think, you know, you look at the teams they perhaps played in their run to that final. There's so many different factors that go into it. A one-off sort of cup game, be it over 2 legs in those sort of knockout stages. There is that element, if not of luck, but that element of anything can happen, really.
But there is a large amount of luck to it as well, because like Manchester City or let's go on the other end and say Liverpool, for example, you would say that the best team in terms of stylistic advantage this year that they could have drawn was Manchester City, because they've beaten them in the league when they were even, and they have this pressing style that kind of plays towards beating City. So like, there is luck in the draw. I mean, unless you believe in UEFA conspiracies and whatnot.
But. Yeah, I don't know if it's luck, if it's chance. I don't know. There's that element of, it's random, right? As you say, right. Liverpool drawing Manchester City. Yeah, is it lucky in a sense? Is it just the chance of it? Real Madrid, as I said, the opponents they had in their run to the final last season was relatively kind. I mean, if they do it 3 times in a row, it will be sensational. But for me, I do think the league achievement is undervalued somewhat. And 7 out of 10 for Barcelona, I know I joke about, you know, the social media team trying to paint that as way more impressive than winning back-to-back European Cups.
But do you also say that because you're a Spurs fan, Adam, and you're going to forever miss out on the league, huh?
Let's move on to Iniesta. Speaking of era-defining players and moments, Iniesta, the Barcelona Spain legend, he did announce he was leaving the club at the end of the season. What, nearly 700 appearances, 32 trophies in total, 9 league titles, as you mentioned there, Nico. He is, of course, accepting a lucrative move to China by the looks of it. But, Chris, what a legacy he leaves at Barcelona.
Oh, yeah, tremendous one. A beautiful player who, I think, for me, almost reinforces the beauty of football, because I don't think there are many sports that have such a wide scope of differing athletes in it. And what I mean by that is, from a size perspective, tall, small, chunkier, skinnier, that kind of thing. It's a very inclusive game in that way, football. And I think Iniesta really kind of typifies that. And I appreciate what's been said about him and Ballon d'Or. I think that's a really pointless debate to have at this stage. But I think what I can say is that
around that period of sort of 2008 to 2012, he was a truly beautiful footballer to watch. He was someone that understood the game, and I think the best words I had heard attributed about him were from Fernando Torres, which were loosely, to paraphrase him, when he got the ball, everything else slowed down.
How do we expect Barcelona to cope without Iniesta, Nico? Do we expect Philippe Coutinho perhaps to be seen as his direct replacement?
I think they're very different sort of stylistic players. I see more Coutinho as like an inside forward and someone that's going to be always farther up the field than Iniesta ever was. There was a lot of criticism at some point in time when I think statistics and their use in the mainstream media was like very in the very infancy, and a lot of people would say, well, you know, Iniesta has a terrible goal. I think Sergio Ramos has a better goal tally for Real Madrid than Iniesta does. So, but that obviously does not speak to the immense impact that he had on that team, both in their, you know, incredible period of dominance with Pep Guardiola and Messi and everything that they were able to achieve, I think, as the first team to win six trophies in 1 year. But just to kind of to look at it from a different way, I mean, we looked at his part. I think the main part of his legacy was his partnership with Xavi and in that midfield, and how almost telepathic I think a lot of people imagine that was. And there was a documentary a while ago that kind of, they had interviews with both of them, and they kind of talked about how they just kind of knew where they were. And it was the very first sort of global representation of a group of guys, really, or a group of players, rather, that have played together for such a long time that it almost seemed like they always knew where each other was going to be on the pitch. And I think it's interesting to see that dynamic has continued to be in Spain. We've gone from the greatest midfield duo of all time, you know, possibly being Xavi and Iniesta, to another historic midfield duo staying in Spain and being at Real Madrid with Luka Modric and Toni Kroos. So Spain, La Liga specifically, enjoying two of the best midfield combos of all time in consecutive fashion is a pretty crazy thing. Yeah.
I love that Iniesta was the... I mean, you mentioned there about how some people used to criticise him for his lack of goals, lack of end product, as it were. But yeah, he was the man who scored the all-important goal in the 2010 World Cup final. I think that's quite fitting. But yeah. Andres Iniesta leaving Barcelona at the end of the season. Before we wrap up, before we move to the end of the podcast, any other business from this weekend? There was the Serie A title race, Nico, taking another twist, another turn. A week after Napoli seemed to have pulled it back from the brink when they narrowed the gap down to 1 point. It's all gone horribly wrong this weekend.
It has all gone horribly wrong. It is now Juventus's to lose. They were two goals down from their desired result, which was a win against Inter. And then they magically, through subbing Paulo Dybala on and Higuain header, and I think in the 93rd minute, they were able to come back. A lot of people, there was a lot of VAR decisions in this game, and specifically one at the beginning of the match that retrospectively gave an Inter player a red card, and then Miralem Pjanic committing what, in many people's eyes, was several second yellow card fouls, but VAR not stepping in on those occasions. So the Calciopolo scandal continuing with Juventus there. But yeah, they came back against Inter, which was an incredible game to watch. And then it was sort of, you know, Napoli, who last week had beat Juventus to kind of close the gap to 1 point again, had it all to play for the next day, only to lose 3-0 in some controversial VAR, not necessarily controversial, but some VAR decisions as well. Kalidou Koulibaly, I think in the 8th minute, fouled a Fiorentina player right outside the box. Initially, it was given by the referee, it was a penalty and a yellow card for Koulibaly. And then when they went back and looked at it on the, you know, video assistant referee, it was a red card for Koulibaly and no penalty, which would eventually necessarily be inconsequential as they lost 3-0. I think a brace or a hat trick, I forget, but it's either a brace or a hat trick from Diego Simeone's son, who they call Cholito. So yeah, it's really exciting. Now the gap is, I think, 4 points, or yeah, 4 points. Unfortunately, unless Juventus lose two games or lose one game and draw, the Serie A title race is kind of Juventus's to lose.
What do you make of the application of VAR, Nico? Because I think broadly speaking, people are for it, but it's the execution of it that seems to grate with many. It's the uncertainty, it's the confusion. Is it simply that, you know, this is a new process that football fans and the game needs to adjust to, or is there a better way to integrate it into the game?
I think, like anything, people are going to be impatient about these things and expect far too much at the beginning. Like, we're humans. We're meant to break things. Everything that, like, if you ask a group of people not to do something, they will likely do it and then do it 15 times over. Like, it just will take a little bit of time for this to be seamlessly implemented. And I think a lot of these situations were rightly handled by VAR. And it kind of made me think, in context of the Koulibaly foul, like, that's a decision that I think no one would have argued with having seen that, unless you watch the replay over and over and over again, because the video assistant referee was able to see the exact position that Koulibaly fouled him and kind of retrospectively made those decisions. And you just kind of wonder how many games that were, you know, that had significant officiating decisions like that, that nobody really questioned because it looked like what it looked like, unless you kind of went back and really took apart the decision. How many games have sort of been, by, I guess, the metaphysical properties, been decided incorrectly because that changed the very fiber of the game. Had Koulibaly stayed on, then you would have said Napoli probably would have won that game. They're a much better team than Fiorentina, but, you know, they had to expose themselves. They knew they had to win. They had to sort of go forward and make themselves vulnerable. So I like the kind of use of VAR. I think it'll get better as time goes on. And it's just something that if people have a little bit of patience with, then it will get better. But if you constantly bitch and complain about it, then you're just going to not like it.
It does feel like the main issue is that lack of communication, Chris, in how the decision-making process progresses when using VAR. We saw a couple of weeks ago it was announced the Premier League will not be implementing VAR next season. The clubs have voted to extend trials for another year. Do you think that's needed before it's refined enough to be used in the Premier League, to be accepted?
Yeah, I think part of the problem is knowing when to apply it. That's the difficulty, you know, in the same way that you don't ring 999 when you cut your finger. I think VAR has applications that will provide clarity and others where it won't, because long before we had VAR, there were many a time when you would have a video replay again, which was another, remember, video replay is an innovation within sport, specifically football. And there have been times when we've had the ability to replay an incident and still not receive clarity on it. And I think the same allowances need to be made for VAR, because it doesn't provide, I think, clear and defined answers to every single problem that you throw into it. I think that's the problem, is that some people are reacting to VAR as if it's some kind of cure-all, and that if it doesn't solve every problem, then it can't solve any problem, and that's not really the best way to look at it.
And on that note, that is the end of today's Front Free Football podcast. Guys, thank you so much for listening. Hope you enjoyed it. Hope you're excited about the future of the Front Three, as excited as we are. We're going to be back tomorrow with a match reaction after Real Madrid Bayern Munich to give some immediate analysis and insight. But until then, until tomorrow, Chris, where can the listeners, where can the whole find you?
On our brand new Twitter account.
Hey, looks great, doesn't it, Nico?
Love the new design.
No issue. Nico, where can people find you?
They can find me on Twitter. I recently wrote something. I published it on Friday talking about Manchester City, their consistency, difficulty, stuff like that. Go check it out. People like it some for some reason. I thought people were going to hate it, but they like it. So
we'll be back tomorrow. We'll see you then.
That's a magic number. Yes, it is. It's the magic number.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices.
Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.